Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Ngā mihi, MOTAT. It's Dear Science time. Alan.
Right. So we're going to kick off this week with how to brew the perfect espresso, which is probably a subject dear to many people's hearts, yeah. I would imagine. I've got to say, I'm not a coffee drinker.
Right.
I'll drink it, but I'm more a fruit tea man.
Right.
But yeah.
I hear the 28 seconds or 28 to 31 seconds that I tried to brew my coffee for this morning may not be right.
Well, this is an application of science to, I guess, an everyday thing. And so there's some researchers in all around the world, basically, in Australia, the UK, Ireland, the USA, and Switzerland. And they've got together and written a paper which is called Systematically Improving Espresso, Insights from Mathematical Modeling and Experiment. And they published this in the journal Matter last week. And you might think, okay, so what are these people doing to investigate how to make a good espresso? Well, the interesting thing about this paper, in my view anyway, is that one of the lead authors is in fact a mathematician. And what they've done is use mathematics, or mathematical modeling, I guess, to try and figure out whether it's best to grind your grounds really, really, really fine, or perhaps not so fine. And that's the big question. Now, if you read the paper, it will probably seem a little bit incomprehensible, as certainly it did to me, because it's full of these nasty things called partial differential equations. Not sure if any of you guys have done maths at university,
a little bit.
Yeah. Not me.
Don't remember much.
Yeah, evil, evil bloody things. but basically, as I say, they're taking a mathematical approach to trying to figure out the best way of making a cup of espresso. So it's long been thought, I guess popular opinion or conventional wisdom or whatever, that the finer that you grind your grounds, the better that your espresso is going to be. A, because very, very fine grounds can dissolve more easily. And B, if you've got nice fine grounds, then that gives you a nice bed of grounds that the water has got to get through and extract all the flavors out. And the longer that the water takes to get through that, the more flavor it's going to extract. So there's your conventional wisdom. Choose the finest setting on your espresso machine if you're lucky enough to own one of those. However, these guys, with their mathematical modeling and also experiments, they think that, no, that's not quite the way to go. And they got together with, in fact, the owner of a coffee shop in Eugene, Oregon. And they did a few experiments. And basically what they found was, no, don't grind your grounds to the finest that you can. And the reason for that is that once you get really, really, really fine grounds, then what happens is that certain parts of the bed of the coffee grounds clog up. And so when you're putting your hot water through those coffee grounds and extracting all those lovely flavor materials, what then apparently happens is that if part of the bed clogs up, then what the hot water is going to do is it's going to go to other parts of the bed, flow through that, and it's going to over-extract the coffee from those ground beans, and it's going to leave these ones alone. So what you get, apparently, according to people who know these sorts of things, tasters, etc., that says that you can you get this really sort of nasty taste of over-extracted beans. And you seemingly don't want that. And so they found, through a combination of theory and experiment, which is always a good way to do science, that if you didn't go to the finest setting, so you left your grounds a little bit more coarse, that gave you a better flavor profile. And again, as I say, that's contrary to popular wisdom. Now, you might think, okay, whoop-de-doo, these are just sort of academics with nothing better to do with their time than to sort of play around with sort of maths and coffee and stuff. Coffee and maths probably actually go together very, very well. You see awful lot of academics around sort of every bloody department with
cups of coffee. I'm sure mathematicians are very well acquainted with coffee.
I think they very probably are. And you might think this is just a purely academic sort of exercise. And in fact, it's not, because as I said, one of the authors on this paper is an owner of a coffee shop. And so what they did was actually a year-long experiment where they got the coffee owner to use a smaller amount of more coarsely ground coffee as opposed to a larger amount of more finely ground coffee. So he's using 15 grams of the coarse stuff as opposed to 20 grams of the very, very fine stuff. And what they found was that the coarse stuff tasted better, and in fact, over that 1 year period, they saved $3,600 in coffee. So this is not a purely academic exercise. I guess it's an exercise in taste, obviously, and economy. And I think that's kind of cool. So this is really applied science.
How many people does it take to say that the coffee tastes better to make sure that the coffee does taste better?
That's a very good question. I assume there's some coffee connoisseurs or something out there who know such things, but I guess it's probably a very subjective thing as well. But, you know, seemingly they've had no complaints. They're making more money, and so probably everybody's happy. The coffee's tasting better, and it's cheaper. So
perhaps I'll pass that knowledge on to some people I know. Where are we going next? I hear it's not to do with coffee.
No, indeed, not to go with coffee, or not to do with coffee, but we're going up into the sky. Now, I don't know whether anybody's been watching the sky over the past wee while. Actually, it's been lovely. There's been some lovely clear nights and stuff, and you get some really, really wonderful... yeah, I think I was out on Sunday night. I was out. I think it was absolutely gorgeous. You got a beautiful view of this. In fact, one constellation that we're going to be talking about, this constellation is called Orion, who is the... No.
The doesn't he have a belt?
He does have a belt. What's he got in his belt?
A sword.
He's got a sword. Very good.
Is there some form of skin as well attached to it, or is that something else?
No, it's certainly a sword. So he's Orion the Hunter.
Ah, yes. That's why he... In mythology, perhaps not the stars, have a skin attached to his belt. Anyway.
I always thought that those sort of, you know, ancient Greeks, Romans or whatever who came up with the constellations first up, they had bloody good imaginations because,
connecting the dots.
These things don't look anything
it's like when a small child presents you with a drawing and you're like,
absolutely.
I can see that giraffe. Anyways, what's happening with Orion?
Well, what is happening with Orion is that a star, which is one of the members of the constellation, is getting dimmer. And that star is called Betelgeuse. And anybody who's ever read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy would probably be au fait with that particular star. It's quite an amazing star. It's what we call a red giant. And if you look up, you can actually see it does appear actually quite red. It in Rome and in Athens and all those ancient places, Betelgeuse actually appears, I think, as the shoulder of Orion. Here in the Southern Hemisphere, we see it upside down. So it's the bottom right star. If you know where Orion is, you look for that belt, three stars in a row, then go down to the bottom right of that. And if you look really closely, you'll see it does look distinctly red. However, what has happened over the past wee while, over the past few weeks, is that this star has started dimming quite dramatically. And it's a little bit weird because it does actually have this sort of natural oscillation. So it gets brighter, it gets dimmer, it gets brighter, it gets dimmer. And it oscillates somewhere between about the fifth brightest and the 19th brightest star in the heavens that
Just
we can see.
Small range.
Well, I guess
it is so when you think about all of the stars.
Oh, yes indeed. But there's very, very few really, really bright stars out there. So this is one of the top 20. But now it's fallen out of the top 20. Sounds almost musical, that, doesn't it?
Orion needs a shoulder replacement.
And so what people are thinking is that this might possibly be a prelude to a supernova, which would be really, really cool. Okay, so what's a supernova? A supernova is basically when a star has used up all of its fuel and it collapses in on itself and it gives out a truck load of energy and it turns into a white dwarf or a neutron star or whatever. And the energy is emitted, obviously some of it is light, and you get to see amazing things. The last enormous supernova that sort of you could see with the naked eye was in the year 1054.
A couple of weeks ago.
They're not particularly common things. So I say see with the naked eye, you could actually see this one with the naked eye in the daytime.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this was an almighty explosion. And they think that Betelgeuse is certainly going to go that way because at the moment it is a red giant. And when I say a giant, okay, if we consider our solar system, Betelgeuse is around about 10 to 20 times the mass of our sun. But in terms of the radius, its radius, it would go out past Jupiter, which is a long way.
It's just a small little star.
It's freaking enormous. It really is. Quite huge. And one day, someday in the future, that all is going to collapse in on itself and it's going to go supernova. So this astronomers think is often a prelude to this happening, is that you start getting sort of big intensity variations and stuff like that. Although it could be a perfectly innocent explanation, another explanation for this. They're not sure, but what they did do a few days ago is that they detected some gravitational waves that were coming from the direction of Betelgeuse. And again, that could well be a prelude to something happening. So basically, watch the space. Yeah. Get out there at night and have a look.
Is there a time frame for our new Pretty Lights show? Or
no, there's absolutely not. Nobody knows when this is going to happen. They know it is going to happen, but it could happen tomorrow. It could happen in the thousands of years' time. Right. But whatever, it's 642 light years away from us. So whatever we're seeing now happened 642 years ago.
Right.
Which always boggles the mind.
Yeah,
I know.
I can't remember what happened yesterday, let alone now. Anyway, moving swiftly on, we've got a tiny little bit of time for this last topic.
We do. And another paper that really took my fancy, and this one is titled, "Will Any Crap We Put Into Graphene Increase Its Electrocatalytic Effect?"
Who, what, where, how, why?
What the hell does that mean?
And this is published in an American Chemical Society journal, so it really is a very high-ranking journal. And it's the first time I have seen the word crap in a paper title. Essentially, to cut a long story short, they're working with this stuff called graphene. Graphene was discovered in 2004 by taking basically pencil lead, graphite, putting some sticky tape on it, and peeling the sticky tape off really carefully. And what that does is it peels off one layer of graphite at a time. And they call that single layer, they call it graphene. And it's got some remarkable properties, foremost of which is the fact that it can catalyze particular reactions that use electrons or need electrons. And this is so-called electrocatalysis. So lots of people are studying graphene and seeing how they can improve that electrocatalysis. And there's lots of papers out there, and people are adding any old stuff to graphene, and they find invariably that it improves its properties, just adding any old thing. So this Czech professor from Prague, Martin Pumara, he thought, this is all nonsense. All that they're studying is just impurities in the graphene. That was his sort of premise. And so what he did was he took bird shit. And he added the graphene, and he did a complete scientific study of the electrocatalytic properties of this, what we call doped graphene that had been doped with guano.
Right.
And he found, yes, surprisingly enough, yep, it improved it and everything. So hence the title of the paper, "Will Any Crap We Put Into Graphene Increase Its Electrocatalytic Effect?"
So his paper was essentially... Well, his theory was proved.
Well, he's basically saying, you can throw anything in here and it's gonna improve it. And all that you're looking at is some sort of impurity in your starting material anyway. That was the point that he was making. A very, very relevant point. It's a very, very serious paper, actually, despite its title. Mm. And it's one that will sort of go down, I guess, in the annals, and it will be cited quite a lot. And it will certainly... be used in undergraduate lectures, and it'll get a laugh. So
Well, watch this space of next week. We find something else put into graphene.
Exactly. His point. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Alan.
Not a problem.
That was, of course, Alan Blackman of AUT University, just across the road, and that's Dear Science. We'll be back after a little break.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Busted.